There's something about a uniform.
I guess you could say I went a little crazy when the servicemen started calling.
And that's probably why I married two of them. Bill number one gave me 6 children. Bill number two gave me a headache.
Turns out you don't really need a man half the time. But
if you know a 70-year-old airman, send him my way.
New liquid soft gels from Nature Made. The newest way to fuel your greatness.
Welcome to A New Earth, Awakening to Your Life's Purpose, a worldwide web event.
A New Earth is sponsored in part by Nature Made Liquid Soft Gel Vitamins, the newest way to fuel your greatness.
Well, hi. Welcome, everybody. Welcome to Class 7 of our New Earth web series with author Eckhart Tolle. I want to thank our students from every corner of the world who are joining us live on this journey of discovery. I truly believe that as each one of us becomes more awake and aware in our own lives, so will our families and everyone we encounter, our communities and our countries and eventually our world. And so Eckhart Tolle and I welcome you once again to yet another lesson. Chapter 7, my favorite chapter thus far. Before we get started, we're going to have a moment of silence, and you're going to lead us into that moment of silence. Yes?
Yes. We're already getting used to having moments of silence to start with. And I'll introduce the moment of silence today with a short meditation passage taken from The Power of Now. Mm-hmm. And as I read this short passage, our viewers should already be able to become still as they listen. Mm-hmm. And after I've read it, we'll be still just for half a minute or so. Mm-hmm. So here we go. Mm-hmm. It's all about entering the present moment fully. Mm-hmm. And that begins with using your senses mm-hmm. fully. Mm-hmm. Be where you are. Mm-hmm. Look around. Just look. Don't interpret. Be aware of the silent presence of each thing. Be aware of the space that allows everything to be. Listen to the sounds. Don't judge them. Listen to the silence underneath the sounds. Touch something, anything, and feel and acknowledge its being. Observe the rhythm of your breathing. Feel the air flowing in and out. Feel the life energy inside your body. Allow everything to be within and without. Allow the isness of all things. Move deeply into the now.
That's great.
Yes.
That's great. All right, everybody. Tonight, we're discussing Chapter 7, Finding Who You Truly Are, which I know is the reason why so many of you picked up this book in the first place, because when I first announced it, I was reading the subtitle that the book is A New Earth, Awakening to Your Life's Purpose. And going on the message boards, and so many people were saying, I hope this book helps me discover my purpose. I hope this book allows me to find who I am. Well, if you're ready, tonight's your night. Let's start with an overview of what this chapter is really about. You say that it is about, you begin with know thyself. Chapter 7 starts with those two words that you say are inscribed above the entrance of a famous Greek temple. You say on page 186, what those words imply is this. Before you ask any other questions, first ask the most fundamental question of your life. Who am I? And then you say on page 189 that you are not the ego. So when you become aware of the ego in you, it doesn't mean you know who you are. It means you know who you're not. But it is through knowing who you are not that the greatest obstacle to truly knowing yourself is removed. So let's start off with these two questions. Who aren't I? And who am I?
And of course, the best starting point is the first question.
Who aren't I?
Because what is left when you realize, and it's usually a process for most people, realizing who you are not, letting go of identification with things and so on. When you realize who you are not, then suddenly who you are becomes revealed to you. And who you are cannot easily be put into words, because if it could, then it could be answered in one simple sentence, and then everybody could repeat that answer and believe that they know who they are.
That's right.
So we start with knowing who you are not, and that begins for people sometimes with loss, where they lose something valuable that they had identified with, or death comes into their lives, some kind of breakdown or disaster happens. Sometimes those people suddenly
awaken.
Something has been taken away from them that they had identified with for many years, that had become part of their sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
And if something very fundamental that has been part of your sense of self is removed, death, loss,
even
collapse.
If it's a person, a human being
it could
who,
be somebody,
who you loved.
Yes, it could
yeah.
be somebody close to you who dies.
Mm-hmm.
Then, of course, at first it leads to enormous suffering, and you feel as if part of you had died also.
Mm-hmm.
And for some people that happens even if they lose possessions,
mm-hmm.
because they were so identified with their possessions
mm-hmm.
that when their possessions are removed, they feel there's nothing left of me.
Mm-hmm.
Another related to possessions is social position.
Mm-hmm.
If people fall from some high social position, there's
right.
a scandal, it happens all the time in the news.
Yes.
Not mentioning any names.
Yes, don't. You don't have to.
And then these people can be extremely painful if they had become totally identified with either their possessions or their social position, and they are
mm-hmm.
suddenly faced with a kind of huge emptiness in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question arises, I'm nobody anymore. And this is the point, a decisive point is reached there where they can either continue to resist and suffer, resist what has happened internally,
mm-hmm.
complain about it, tell themselves story about it, how it's all collapsed, or they can suddenly come to a point of acceptance of what happened and acceptance of the present moment. So the thing that was so important in their lives actually left behind. I sometimes compare it to, if you look at a person's life, it's a tapestry, consists mm-hmm. of all kinds of things that one identifies with.
Right.
And when a great loss happens, it's almost as if suddenly there's a huge hole in that tapestry of my life.
Correct.
And that is painful when you identify with the tapestry, but behind the tapestry there's a light that shines through, because without the light there wouldn't be anything at all. That's why you can even see your life. Without the light of consciousness, nothing would be.
Behind the tapestry there's a light.
I'm using a kind of analogy.
Mm-hmm.
So when you don't resist this hole that has suddenly appeared in this tapestry of your life,
mm-hmm.
then there's a light that shines through then, and I'm using it as an analogy.
Mm-hmm.
There's suddenly a peace that comes when the emptiness that is left behind by the form that has dissolved
mm-hmm.
is not resisted internally.
Mm.
And then through that empty space, there comes what the Bible calls the peace that passes all understanding.
Mm.
Because you can't explain suddenly, and people have reported that this has happened to them. They lost sometimes, in some cases, everything. They suffered at first, and then suddenly an inner shift happened. They accept it.
And this also happens when you are grieving somebody that you loved, isn't it true? Because
yes.
When you come to understand fully who you are, it doesn't mean that you will no longer be saddened when you lose loved ones.
No.
But you will also, when you become more, when you become conscious, you then understand that they have just moved from form to formless, and that the formless can have an easier way to come through now, even more strongly
yes.
than it did in the form,
yes.
if you allow yourself to be with it and to see it and to experience it.
Yes, this, what you just said, an example, I was talking to a woman who lost her son.
Mm-hmm.
He had an illness, he was about 28, I believe, and she was sitting next to him at his deathbed, and then the moment he, just the few minutes before he died and just after he died, she could sense an enormous peace descending upon the room and filling mm-hmm. the whole room, and she could feel that there was a sacred presence in the room in the moment of death.
Mm-hmm.
So she had totally surrendered to that. And it's very painful. It's even more painful for a parent to have to witness a child's death mm-hmm. than the other way around. And so that was the most sacred moment in her life. And that lasted for about 10 minutes. And after 10 minutes, her mind came in and suddenly she started crying and protesting.
Mm-hmm.
But that
because
was...
the mind wants the situation to be different.
Yes.
The mind wants you alive again in the physical body. Or the mind wants the thing back that I have lost.
Yes.
The job, the position, the whatever.
Yes.
I think it's harder, though, when it comes to loved ones because there is a connection there. And
yes.
there is, you know, nobody knows what happens.
Yes.
Except maybe you,
yeah.
When we die.
Yeah.
And so there's this feeling that, you know, I have lost someone.
Yes.
Is that feeling selfishness?
No, it's a normal feeling because there was, even if you truly love somebody, of course, what you love in the other person is deeper than the form, the external form of that person. Nevertheless, there's always a little bit, even in true love, there's always a little bit of attachment to the form also
mm-hmm.
because the light comes through the form.
The light comes through the form.
Yes.
All right, let's go here to page 186, everybody. This is one of my favorite things. A second, I have a cold, so if I look like I'm sucking on a cough drop, unconscious people, and many remain unconscious, trapped in their egos throughout their lives, will quickly tell you who they are, their name, their occupation, their personal history, the shape or state of their body, and whatever they identify with. Others may appear to be more evolved because they think of themselves as an immortal soul or divine spirit. But do they really know themselves? Or have they just added some spiritual sounding concepts to the content of their mind? Knowing yourself goes far deeper than the adoption of a set of ideas or beliefs. Spiritual ideas and beliefs may at best be helpful pointers, but in themselves, they rarely have the power to dislodge the more firmly established core concepts of who you think you are, which are part of the conditioning of the human mind. This is my favorite in this chapter, one of my favorites. I have 3 stars, then another star when I read it the second time, and another star. Knowing yourself deeply has nothing to do with whatever ideas are floating around in your mind. Knowing yourself is to be rooted in being instead of lost in your mind.
Yes, yes.
That was beautifully written.
Yes. And so I mentioned that because some people are identified, many people are identified with external things. You mentioned, I believe, a week or two ago, somebody mentioned to you that they suddenly realized that they are not their car.
They're not their car.
That's yeah. the beginning,
yes.
early stage of disidentification,
mm-hmm.
but it's good.
But we do think we are, and that's why you wrote the whole chapter, we do think we are our roles.
Yes,
you know,
our roles.
Because a lot of people have important roles, roles as parents and
yes.
roles in important positions that affect
yes.
a lot of people's lives.
Yes.
And people think that they are their roles and they identify with their status in the world
that's
and what
right.
they have achieved.
That's right. And of course, it's a question of finding a balance of honoring the role, of honoring the function that you have in this world. So that's fine. You have to do whatever you're doing. You fulfill your function as mother, as father, or in some other capacity, some public function, business function, whatever it is. So to honor the function without becoming totally identified with the function, so that always there's still a human being there, not yes. just a function.
So knowing yourself deeply has nothing to do with whatever ideas are floating around in your mind, meaning knowing yourself deeply has nothing to do with me being on television every day, speaking to people, and even maybe doing a good job at it, actually doing a good job at it.
Yeah.
And all the great jobs that everybody else is doing who's listening. Those are identifications.
Identifications.
With form.
Yes. And also, what I meant, what you just read, is people sometimes have certain ideas in their mind of who they are, and mm-hmm. they may be spiritual ideas. Mm-hmm. I'm eternal spirit. That's, of course, wonderful. And basically, it is true, but do you truly know that? Because in order to truly know that you are more, you are much deeper than this form, goes far beyond holding certain concepts in your mind.
Yeah.
It goes, this kind of knowing is a knowing that it goes beyond conceptual
knowing.
Because
if you really knew that, you would have a certain way of being or living in the world
yes.
that would manifest that in the world.
Exactly.
And that would manifest your being in
that's
the world.
Right. And particularly when situations happened, your reaction to a situation always tells you where you are at as far as your level of consciousness.
That is why a lot of people become annoyed with people who claim to be so spiritual or so religious,
yes.
who are intolerant of other people,
yes.
intolerant of other ideas, self-righteous, imposing their ideas on other people, because if you truly were what you say you are.
Yes.
So moving on to who you think you are, this is one of my beautiful statements here. On page 187, everybody, if small things have the power to disturb you, then who you think you are is exactly that small. That will be your unconscious belief. What are the small things? Ultimately, all things are small things because all things are transient. And you say, your sense of who you are determines what you perceive or as your needs and what matters to you in life, and whatever matters to you will have the power to upset and disturb you. So people all the time say, you know, I'm a peaceful person, I'm a loving person.
Yes.
I'm a kind person, I'm a generous person, I'm a good person.
Yes. And then the slightest thing goes wrong, and suddenly something else comes up, which is total opposite of the good person. And so this is not the deep knowing of who you are. The deep knowing really is, we use the word know here in a somewhat differently from the conventional way of using the word know. Usually knowing is conceptual knowing.
Right.
So the analogy one could have, which is sometimes given, is with honey.
Mm-hmm.
You can examine the chemical makeup of honey. You can examine the molecular structure of honey.
I can tell you it's sweet.
You can write a PhD about honey, or you can write poems about honey. But if you have never tasted honey, in other words, if honey has not merged with you,
mm-hmm.
then you don't really know honey. But the moment you taste honey, then you know honey. And all the other stuff beforehand, even your PhD about honey, if you wrote one, is not knowing, not true
knowing.
Knowing.
Yes.
It's only conceptual.
Okay. So to be rooted in being instead of lost in your mind. And what does that mean, to be rooted in being?
And again, we are using words here to describe something that really is beyond words.
It's not describable.
Yeah.
Yes.
But just a little hint is, we always come back, of course, here in this teaching to the present moment.
Absolutely.
So when your attention moves fully into the present moment, at that moment you go deeper into being.
Mm-hmm.
You could say that life has two dimensions. There's the horizontal dimension of life, past, future, where everything happens. And most people, their whole existence is on that horizontal surface dimension.
And they think that's their life.
They think that's all there is.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, then life is quite a threatening place because you
all never, that is transient. It changes.
Very transient.
Yeah.
And you've never encountered the deeper dimension. This, by the way, is a few people have interpreted the Christian cross, which we mentioned also mm-hmm. last time in a slightly different context. The Christian cross as being showing the horizontal dimension of life, and suddenly it intersects with the vertical dimension.
Mm.
It's also the dimension of the sacred.
Yes.
And so you enter the vertical dimension, by becoming present, by bringing your attention into the now. So then, because then past and future disappear from your consciousness. Uh-huh. And at this moment, there's only the now. And suddenly, a depth opens up within you.
And so what you've been saying throughout this book is that if you are living your life in the horizontal, the past and the future, then you're not really living. You are making enemies of this present moment.
Yes.
And you're not truly living.
Yes.
And that when you say, what I interpret what you say, knowing yourself is to be rooted in being instead of lost in your mind, is to, in every encounter, and I've been doing this more and more, coming back to your breath.
Yes.
Coming back to the present moment in such a way that you are aware and conscious of everything that's going on around you. And recognizing that you are that awareness. That's who you are. You are, yes, the observer of all these things that are going on in the horizontal plane of your life.
Exactly. So with the vertical comes the witnessing presence, the
that's
observer.
Right. Yeah.
Oh, that's the liberation. Sometimes this word liberation is used in spiritual context. Mm-hmm. That's the liberation from the horizontal dimension, which Jesus calls the world.
Yes. You know, may I should just share this? I know we have Debbie from the Netherlands on Skype, but maybe this will help illustrate this for you. A couple of years ago, I wrote this in my magazine for one of the What I Know For Sures. I was walking with my friend Bob Green on New Year's Day 2 years ago on a mountain in Hawaii, and it was late evening. The sun had set while we were walking, and the moon had come up. And the clouds had come in and come down to the ground where we were. And all of a sudden, we're walking, and we were surrounded by the clouds. We were in the clouds on this mountain. And you could only see a sliver of the moon up ahead, just a sliver of it. And I think Bob made a comment, like, it looks like the DreamWorks logo, the moon. It looks like you can go and sit up there with the fishing pole. And we were walking along, and all of a sudden he turned around and he said, "Can you hear that?" And I stopped, and it was completely, utterly still. It was so still, it makes me want to weep thinking about it. It was so still that it felt like all of time and no time. It felt like the earth had stopped, that everything had stopped. So much so that my very breath was so loud, I began to hold my breath because my breath was making too much noise in the stillness. And in that moment, I understood what you had written in Stillness Speaks, that is always there, that stillness. There's not a bird or a cricket or a frog or a car horn or anything. That is always there.
Yes, and that's also an inner dimension.
And that is the same as I.
Yes.
I am that.
Yes.
I am that stillness.
Yes.
It was a powerful spiritual experience for me. I've never forgotten. I got chills now thinking about it.
It's wonderful.
Because you recognize that is always there. When all the noise and the, you know, fireworks and all the things that go on this mountain, that is always there.
Yes. Consciousness. We could call it, although its labels are always limiting, but
right,
we could say that is pure consciousness, mm-hmm, before consciousness becomes something.
Mm-hmm.
Before it's born into a form, it's there in its pristine, formless, timeless,
yeah,
state.
And in all things, that's why you were asking us to look around the room, there is the stillness of all things. It's easier to determine in nature, though.
Yes.
It's harder with a table.
Yes, it's harder, and
yeah,
even harder with human beings, because
yes,
there's so much mind there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But even in so-called inanimate objects that you perhaps never even haven't looked at for years, they've been around you, sometimes it's wonderful to pick up an object and just be aware of its silent presence,
mm-hmm,
no matter what it is. Because whatever it is, ultimately, nothing is inanimate. And physicists would agree, because if you go deep into any so-called inanimate object, you realize it's intensely alive.
Mm-hmm. It's easy to do with trees, as I said earlier.
Oh, yes.
And so the essence is what we're trying to get here is that is who we are, that stillness.
Yes, that's the essence of our being. That's who we are at the deepest level. This is the timeless dimension within
us. And when you're saying that even when you pass on, when you transition to another, to the formless, that stillness, that consciousness, that spirit, whatever name you choose to give it, still there.
Yes, that awareness is timeless. It's not subject to birth and death. As I have said somewhere, the opposite of life has no opposite. Usually people think in terms of life and death.
Yes.
But really, death is the opposite of birth. It's not the opposite of life. Life in its essence has no opposite. It's eternal.
Debbie's from the Netherlands and lives in the city of Harlem. She's Skyping us from her family room there. I understand you have a question about the quote on page 187 about small things disturbing you. I love this quote. Go ahead, Deb.
Hi, Oprah. Hi, Eckhart.
Hi.
My question is about high sensitivity. I always considered myself as a sensitive person, and that means I'm easily overwhelmed by day-to-day life things that might be considered small. I've been practicing staying in the moment with challenging moments, but I think I need some more advice. Is high sensitivity just a narrow egoic state? And do you have some tools that might help me to stop feeling so overwhelmed by all these small things?
It does sound like a label you've given yourself.
Yeah. I know.
I'm a highly sensitive individual. Yes.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That is true. So that's that also we need to address. Can you give perhaps two or three examples of what kind of things you are very sensitive to?
Well, a lot of things, but usually when I go into a shop and there's loud music there, I just want to run away. I have a hard time dealing with noise and chaos.
Yes, or being in a big city, traffic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I suggest that you experiment a little bit when these situations arise and you feel the same thing happening again. And if you bring a very alert attention to the situation, you realize that really there are three levels to this situation. Level one is whatever it is that disturbs you, the external noise, the chaos, the traffic, whatever it may be. So there's the thing that disturbs you, level one. Level two, there is your reaction to that thing that disturbs you, which could come as it could be an almost physical reaction, as perhaps a contraction in your body. It could be also an emotional reaction of frustration, irritation, anger, I assume, something like that, right? And also, in addition, the reaction could be certain thoughts in your head about the situation that says, I can't stand being here any longer, it's dreadful, dreadful. Right? This is level two. Mm-hmm. Now, be aware of that these two are, first of all, separate. There is the triggering event or situation, and then there is your physical, emotional, mental reaction to that. And now, what is level three? That is usually overlooked. But level three is where ultimately freedom lies. Level three is your awareness of both these levels. You are aware that there is the situation, the event, there is my reaction, physical, emotional, mental, and there is myself being the aware space for those two. And if you can bring your attention more to that deepest level, then you realize changes will happen on the other two levels. If you recognize yourself not as the reacting entity that happens in you, but that's not who you are.
Got it.
But you recognize yourself as the awareness that is aware of the thing that's happening out there, of the thing that's reacting inside.
So
also,
it's actually like, Debbie, you're observing your own behavior. You're observing your ego's behavior to it.
Yes.
You're observing your ego's behavior.
With no judgment, just as pure observation, pure awareness.
Like, oh, isn't that interesting? I'm getting so upset over
Yes.
The sky pulling just, in front of
just
me.
Just being there as the awareness. Mm-hmm. So, and that's already the beginning of freedom. And yeah. then increasingly you realize that you are that, you are not the entity that is reacting. And then, as Oprah said, then you can let go of thinking of yourself, of having this concept of yourself as a highly sensitive person that perhaps you might, it's not natural, nothing personal in this, you may have become attached to because you've lived with this concept of who you are for many years. Mm-hmm. So that's the, that's where freedom lies.
But in addition to Debbie's question, let's say, and for her, you know, she labels herself or defines herself as a highly sensitive person. But let's say a person gets upset about someone putting a dent in his or her car, or you spill coffee on your blouse right before an important meeting, or your child gets sick, or you get sick. Or are you saying that if we get upset about these things, these kinds of things, that we don't know who we truly are?
If the dimension of presence or awareness is missing, then you are lost in the reaction.
Mm-hmm. You think and, you are the reaction.
Yes, then you become the reaction. And when you become the reaction, you don't know who you are. It's a misperception of who you are.
You got that, right, Debbie?
Yeah, I got it. Yeah,
I got it too.
That helped me a lot.
Isn't it good when you get it?
Yeah.
I got it too. And just detaching yourself, that doesn't change the situation.
It doesn't immediately change the situation, but you do find that as you practice this, changes suddenly appear. Changes sometimes first appear in the force that is behind your reaction mm-hmm. that lessens. You react, still react, but less, not as strongly. And miraculously, you sometimes even find that if you're totally, because really the awareness level is also part of the acceptance. Mm-hmm. You completely accept it at this moment, this is what I feel, and this is what the external situation is. With complete acceptance, even changes often happen miraculously in the external situation.
Yeah, I think acceptance of the situation, which you talk about in Power of Now, and also repeatedly in A New Earth, acceptance, non-resistance to the moment, is one of the most important things we can learn.
Yes.
And that is whether or not you are facing a crisis, whether you're facing someone you've lost, a loved one, or whether you're, you know, in traffic and are a highly sensitive person, non-accepting what is in that moment.
Yes.
Is the most important.
Yes. And you can practice with little things because little things happen throughout the day that people feel irritated about, angry about, are protesting against, and so on. Or with little things, you will have many opportunities to practice. So it's a wonderful spiritual practice. So you use what you before you wanted to get rid of, you use it as part of your spiritual practice, and then as a byproduct, you also eventually get rid of it.
Thanks, Debbie. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you.
From the Netherlands, thank you.
Thank you.
Everybody says they want peace, inner peace and peace on earth. On page 188, you say, peace is really what you want. Then you will choose peace. And if peace mattered to you more than anything else, and if you truly knew yourself to be a spirit rather than a little me, you would remain non-reactive and absolutely alert when confronted with challenging people or situations.
Yes.
Yes.
You can either be reactive, act according to the way you've reacted for many years, your past mm-hmm. conditioning, or you can become more alert when a challenging situation happens so that you don't internally separate yourself from the situation. So that when you completely open yourself to the situation, that you bring an alertness to it, an alertness of presence. So you're facing the situation totally with that state of alert presence. Mm-hmm. You're not reactive anymore. And if something needs to be said or done in the situation, the words will suddenly come from that level of consciousness, mm-hmm. from that alert stillness. If you need to do something, then the right doing will happen. Mm-hmm. Instinctively, or instinctively is not the right word, intuitively, the right thing, you will do the right thing. So,
because it will be born out of a sense of presence.
Out of presence.
Or a sense of being, which is another word that we're using.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
That's right.
And so whenever you are upset, about any situation. There's a line in the Course in Miracles that says, I am never upset for the reason I think.
Yes.
So because when you're upset, you have lost yourself on the external level, what we call the horizontal.
But aren't there some things worth upsetting you? I mean, there are injustices in the world, and there are horrible things happening all the time in the world that we should be upset about.
I wouldn't say that we should be upset about. It is normal for people to be upset about this, but it is not the most effective way of bringing about change.
I got it. You can be upset all day long and nothing changes.
Nothing happens.
Because people have been upset for years and things don't change.
Yes. Mm-hmm. People are upset about violence, they're upset about war, continuous war between nations and so on. It continues to happen. And you cannot fight against.
If somebody emailed me today, they said they were upset about 13-year-old girls having to marry so-called ministers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Upset about it, but being upset about it changes nothing.
No. So it's more powerful to face a situation and see this is how it is, and then see if action is possible. What is it that can be done?
Got it.
And then there's no negativity in the action.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are resisting, if you are complaining about a situation already, whatever you do, negativity flows into what you do.
Yeah. I just got something earlier, and the reason I'm thinking about this, because a friend of mine had lost his brother and was saying that, you know, he was having such a hard time letting go. And what I just had in this moment, something clicked for me, is that when people do finally are allowed to move on from their grief, it's because they have come to the point of acceptance that their loved one is gone.
Yes.
And what you're saying is, in any situation, whether it's the loss of a loved one or loss of a position or loss of whatever, that you're faced with, acceptance of the situation and beginning to deal with what is going on now instead of wondering or worrying about what could have been, should have been, might have been, changes the situation and the way you feel about it.
Yes.
And that your pain and suffering is caused and stress is caused because you refuse to accept the now.
Yes, you're not one with the now.
Got it. So tonight we are Skyping with a new study group in West Hollywood, along with Borders, where we've been Skyping in Borders in Chicago. Now we've moved to Hollywood.
Very good.
At the famed Bodhi Tree.
Oh, I love that bookstore. Some years I gave a talk there.
Don't you love that bookstore?
Yes.
I do too. The Bodhi Tree is considered by many to have one of the best book selections in Los Angeles for the mind, body, and spirit. So, hi everybody at Bodhi.
Hi.
God, everybody looks so California-like. we can tell we're not in Chicago. Everybody's all bundled up. I Skyped Tanisha at the Bodhi Tree earlier today on the Oprah Show, and she's back tonight with a question. Hi, Tanisha.
Hi, Oprah. How are you?
Good to see you. And your question?
Yes, my question has to do with reactivity. On page 208, Tolley says, what is reactivity? Becoming addicted to reaction. The more reactive you are, the more entangled you become with form. The more identify with form, the stronger the ego. My question has to do with, I've always related being reactive to being sensitive. And being sensitive allows me to be very passionate about things, allows me to connect with other people, and be emotionally available to my friends and family. So my question is, how can I retain sensitivity and be passionate about things and keep that, but not allow my ego to get stronger?
Great question, Tanisha. Thanks.
Yes. Thank you. Well, reaction may appear to be a sign of sensitivity, but actually, reaction is not sensitive. Reaction is a conditioned way of responding to a situation, and you're not when you. All reaction really comes from the past because it's part of the way in which you have been conditioned. And because it comes from the past, it is never totally adequate to the present moment. So sensitivity is actually lost when you're reactive. And true sensitivity comes when you are absolutely present in the situation and see this is how it is. And you totally face the situation as it is, and with that comes enormous sensitivity. And you can, with that comes also intuition. It's only when you internally don't resist a situation, then the intuitive faculties arise within you. as long as you internally resist a situation, and reactivity is always some form of resistance, mm-hmm. as long as you internally resist, then the intuitive faculties cannot really come in because you're acting out old conditioning. Intuition comes out of presence, out of the present moment. So bringing presence to a situation, then that means you become absolutely sensitive. And that's also a deeper aliveness and a deeper power than what looks like power and aliveness when you observe somebody reacting. Sometimes it might look very passionate, but really they are acting out their past conditioning. The ego is acting out. That's not true passion. It's the ego wanting this or that from the situation, wanting to manipulate the situation, wanting to get something out of the situation, whatever, but not being truly present. So it's only through presence that the true sensitivity is there.
Thank you, Tanisha.
Thank you.
And all you Bodhi people. Thank you so much. The Bodhi tree, love that.
Yes.
Really, that's great. Continuing on with who we are, because I know so many people have this as a prominent question for themselves. You say on page 189, nobody can tell you who you are. It would just be another concept, so it would not change you. Who you are requires no belief. In fact, every belief is an obstacle. What does that mean?
It means who you are has nothing to do with any thought that you might have about yourself.
So does who you are have nothing to do with what you've done? So you've spent your life here doing all this work and working, making money, taking care of your family, doing all the things that people do, and that has nothing to do with you. And then you, at your funeral, they read your, you know, words about you and say, this is who you are?
Well, and then there's the gravestone.
Mm-hmm.
And on the gravestone, there is the date of birth. And there is a 1 or 2 inch dash.
Yes.
And then there's the date of your death. And the dash is really all your ambitions and your fears and your drama and your problems. That's what's left on that level. So I'm not saying not to honor the level of form, because that's what we are talking about. Mm-hmm. Whatever you do in this life, this horizontal level where we do things, where we have our functions and play roles, you honor that level, but realizing there is something more vital, there is something deeper than just that.
Okay. Bridget says, dear Oprah and Eckhart, can you explain the quote on page 192, but nothing you can find out about yourself is you. Nothing you can know about you is you.
Yes.
Okay.
So I'm making a difference here between knowing yourself and knowing about yourself.
Okay.
And I'm mentioned as an example, if you go to a conventional psychoanalyst, let's say,
mm-hmm.
You will spend some years examining the makeup of your conditioning, of your past, your childhood, and so on. You find out more and more about yourself, things that perhaps you hadn't seen clearly,
mm-hmm.
about your emotions, about the makeup of your thoughts,
right.
and so on. And all that is knowing about. It's to do with content.
Right.
The content of my life and the content of my mind, ultimately, because my life is, I know it only as the content of my mind. So that is knowing about yourself. And you can know thousands of facts about yourself and your history,
mm-hmm.
and still not know who you are, because that knowing has nothing to do with conceptual knowing, with bits of information. It's the deeper knowing. I gave the analogy earlier of the honey.
The honey.
You can know about the honey.
Yes.
Or you can taste the honey, because when you taste the honey becomes you. It merges with you.
That's right. That's right.
In that sense, knowing who you are in a non-conceptual way is being fully who you are. It's being in touch with that deeper level of being where that you can only access in the present moment, the vertical dimension.
Can I ask, if you are reading this book and suddenly become to understand, or not reading this book and understand, as you say, many people say, well, I'm a spiritual being, you know, I'm on my spiritual path.
Yes.
As many people have said, you know, as I'm reading all of the message boards, which I love, by the way, keep them coming. say, I've been on the spiritual path for many years, or I'm a spiritual person, aren't you just a little step closer thinking you're a spiritual person, or is that another form of your ego, saying I'm a spiritual person?
Well, you have
Because I've said for years, I recognize I'm spirit.
Yes, that is...
Come from the greater spirit. So
yes.
I can use the word I am consciousness, mm-hmm. come out of the greater consciousness that I call God.
Yes.
Or spirit that come out of the greater consciousness, spirit that I call God.
Yes.
So I recognize that. I know that intellectually.
Yes. So in that sense, you can say intellectually that is a true statement.
Yeah, but I also feel it deeply.
The question is whether, and this is, I know that you do, but mm-hmm. The question is whether you truly feel that as a reality and a way of finding out how deeply you truly know this mm-hmm, is mm-hmm. how you react to situations in your life and how you react to other people in your
mm-hmm,
life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's there that you find out whether your belief that you are spirit, whether you truly know that, or whether it's no more, as I put it, than an idea floating around in your mind.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know it in the depths of your being?
Mm-hmm.
Because then the way in which you deal with situations and people is very different.
Correct. I've always believed that I really was God's child,
yeah.
that I was, you know, come from, and as I've gotten older and could articulate it better, you know, I use other ways of describing it, but I believe that I came from that which is God.
Yes.
And was born of that.
Yes.
And so therefore really have no real fears in the world. I've always believed everything would be okay.
Yes.
And no matter what, I'm going to be okay
yes,
because
and,
of that.
And you can.
And that's more than a belief, actually.
More than a belief, you can sense that.
Yeah.
In some way that it's hard to describe.
Right.
But you can sense that ultimately there isn't you and God. There is a deep place where you and God merge. There
mm-hmm.
is the oneness with that.
Well, I've just gotten that later in life.
Yes.
I used to think God was out there.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Eleanor lives in Boston, Massachusetts, and is Skyping us from a friend's house. Hi, Eleanor.
Hi, Oprah. Hi, Mr. Tolle.
Hello.
This is such a great experience. I really thank you so much for it.
Well, thank you. Your question is?
My question is, on page 192, mm-hmm. you say, you may not want to know yourself because you are afraid of what you may find out.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is about letting go of your insecurities or what you would call your ego. For many years now, I've been handling, so to say, an eating disorder, and it's pretty much been, it's consumed a great part of my identity. That's how I identify myself, and I feel like that causes a great lacking in me.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way, I do want to let go, but then a great part of me just wants to hold on to this identification of myself. And I guess my question is, what is this next step from awakening to the fact that I should move on and acting upon that?
Mm-hmm. That's the deriving your sense of who you are
mm-hmm.
from certain thoughts or mental images that you have about yourself. And that's the normal identity that people have. They derive their sense of self from certain mental images or thoughts they have about themselves, which they repeat to themselves, which they talk to others about.
Yes, it's what Debbie was saying to us earlier from the Netherlands. I'm
yes.
a very sensitive person, so
yes.
therefore lots of things overwhelm me.
Yes.
Yes.
And that's already, that's on one level, that is true, but if you become too identified with a label like that, then that becomes a hindrance in going beyond it.
Mm-hmm.
That's why you immediately said, when she said that, there we have a label.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a similar thing, perhaps, that happens to you. So it's really finding within yourself something that is more powerful, more genuine, more truly who you are than any image that you have in your mind. And we have to come back here to really the essence of this teaching, which is present moment. You have to invite the present moment into your life as frequently as you can. You have to make room for the present moment, because it's only when you make room for the present moment that these images and mental concepts about who you are do not operate. So when you become present, and I've already given hints about how to, little things you can do to become present. At the beginning of our session today, we had this little meditation where we said, be aware of your sense perceptions, touch things, look at things, listen to things without judging, without labeling. Then the alertness rises. The key is here, another word for presence is the alertness. And so you become alert also within. You feel the aliveness of your inner body. Rather than having a mental concept of who you are, you feel the entire energy field, that which animates the physical form, and yes, you are in touch with that.
Yeah, and Eleanor, what I would say, add to that is that you haven't done that enough, because once you start to do that, when you get in touch with the inner body, when you begin to feel the inner space, when you begin to feel the presence and being that is really you, you realize you're bigger than your little self with an eating disorder.
Mm-hmm.
When you start, and the reason why you're still attached to this idea of having an eating disorder, because that's as big as you know yourself to be right now. And when you know yourself to be something more, you will choose to be the something more and not this little me that has an eating disorder. That's how I see it.
Yes, that's it.
That's how I see it.
Yes.
And that's why you're clinging to it, because you don't know who you are. Because you don't know who you are.
It's very difficult to move beyond that. I mean, I may, in my mind, understand that intellectually, that I'm greater than this issue,
but
it's
not gonna. You're not gonna help yourself through your mind.
Right.
That's what Eckhart is saying in this whole book, that real healing, real everything, creativity, real joy, real presence and being comes from that space, the inner space of consciousness or presence and being. And the reason why you're attached to the idea, because that works for you. Mm-hmm. That works for you right now.
Very easy.
Yeah,
safe.
That works for you because you like playing small right now. And so maybe you're not ready. But what he just described for you is exactly, and it doesn't happen overnight. It doesn't mean that, you know, tomorrow you're gonna wake up and not have an issue. It's slowly bringing more and more consciousness into your daily way of being that allows
it's
you
It's a lot of effort, that's for sure.
And I would say this, Eleanor, I would say you're worth it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
I would say you're worth the effort.
Yes.
I would say you're
Thank
worth
you.
The effort.
Thank you.
I want to move on to abundance. And there was a question that I had earlier that you had on here about abundance. I love that question. But there's a lot in Chapter 7 about abundance and that we are not the little me that we think we are. You say on page 190, whatever you think the world is withholding from you, you are withholding from the world. And you are withholding it because deep down you think you're small and that you have nothing to give.
Mm-hmm.
Try this for a couple of weeks and see how it changes your reality. Whatever you think people are withholding from you, praise, appreciation, assistance, loving, care, and so on, give it to them. So is abundance, I was looking, do you have that question to put back here, the abundance question that somebody had asked in email? What's so great about this, I think, is that it's something people can do every day right now, is to start to give that which you say you most want.
Yes. And it starts with recognizing external abundance. That if the act of recognition that there's external abundance, and what that is we'll see in a second, is the act of recognition of external abundance already brings out the abundance that is an essential part of your very being.
Mm-hmm.
So when you recognize abundance without, and what I'm suggesting there is to look at, you're walking past a store where there's a display of fruit, apples, oranges, and you see the abundance and the aliveness that is there.
Mm-hmm.
You acknowledge it there.
Mm-hmm.
Abundance doesn't mean that you need to buy many things. You can buy or not buy.
Mm-hmm.
But it's you see the abundance of water, rain falling from the sky. There's an abundance of water. There's an abundance of aliveness. There's an abundance of joy in the dog that's going past you there. And so to recognize, to see the abundance that surrounds you, even if you're very poor in the eyes of the world, the abundance is always there around you, but you need to recognize it, acknowledge it. And another word for that is gratitude.
I know. I was going to say, that's why I've kept a gratitude journal for years.
Yes.
If you keep a gratitude journal, listening, I do this thing, just the five things in the day that made you most grateful, what you start to notice is that there are more things added to your list. And you don't even have time to write them all.
Yes.
And when you start to pay attention to the things, okay? And you also say acknowledging the good that is already in your life is the foundation for all abundance.
Yes. And again, many people make that mistake because they believe that there is nothing good in my life. Mm-hmm. And that's absurd. It means they are not present. They are trapped in certain stories in their head which tell them continuously that there is nothing good in my life. And if they only opened their eyes and looked around, and if they smelled the air, saw the sunlight, the most abundant thing you can see is the sun.
Well, I think the most abundant thing you can have is your breath.
The breath?
Come back to your breath.
Yes,
come back to the breath.
So you can be with that and...
When you can't think of anything to be grateful for, go to your breath.
Breath or the aliveness in your hands and in your arms to feel that.
Well, the email question from Rosanita in Georgia was to ask you to please explain what you mean by abundance comes only to those who already have.
Yes. Now, abundance, you need to recognize that as coming from within you. Abundance is not something that external things come to you that make you abundant. Abundant is the energy that flows out of you, out of the being of who you are, into this world.
Mm-hmm.
So the beginning of, you initiate this process by recognizing the abundance that's all around you externally.
Outflow determines inflow.
And then it suddenly, the recognition already draws it out, you see.
I was going to say, isn't gratitude in itself an energy field that draws more to you?
Yes.
Isn't it its own vibrational frequency
that
draws more to you?
Yes.
And that's what I interpreted you saying.
That's it.
Is that gratitude is its own energy field.
Yes.
And that when you acknowledge and are grateful for whatever you have, when you can see and feel the gratitude, experience the gratitude in whatever you have, that changes your vibrational frequency, literally.
Yes.
And allows more to be drawn to you.
Yes. It changes your entire reality. It changes the way in which you experience life.
Yes, it does.
It changes your world. And so it's if that's the only thing people remember, there are many things in this book, but just if they want to change their lives, they're not happy with their lives, bring gratitude into it, which is, of course, connected also to the present moment because it's only here in this moment. What is it in this moment that I can be grateful for? And then you suddenly say, oh, it's all that. It's miraculous if you truly look around and sense and feel. It's miraculous. The entire universe is miraculous.
Yes.
And when you are so trapped in your thoughts that you don't see this anymore, then the entire universe becomes dead to you and there's nothing new that ever arises.
You know, I was practicing this weekend. I was saying to Eckhart before we started that I was under the weather and had an obligation in New Orleans and wasn't able to fulfill that commitment. And normally I would have just been beating myself up about it because I've never had to cancel anything before. But I decided to be with the fact that I was sick. And I had that one of the happiest days of my life, being sick in bed, because I accepted it and was not fighting the fact that I wasn't well. I thought, I'm going to be with feeling badly, and I'm going to appreciate everything about the day. So every cup of tea that Stedman brought me, I was happy. And happy that I was, you know, I had clean sheets. I mean, and happy that I could open the curtains and there was sun coming through the window. And I just had the most happy time being sick in bed.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's what you're talking about.
Yes.
Being able to be grateful from where you are.
Yes, very powerful.
Yeah, if I hadn't read this book, I might not have been able to do that. So it's been very helpful to me. Go ahead.
Sorry, you can even be grateful for things that on the surface don't look so good.
Mm-hmm.
When you accept what is, you're grateful whatever situation arises. Let's say your car breaks down and you have to change the tire in the middle of the night. And even there, you can say, okay, we come to this later in the book. It begins sometimes a so-called negative situation. It begins with not resisting it.
Yes.
And so...
Don't you say in the power of now, I just interrupted a thought.
Yeah.
But don't you say in the power of now that all stress comes from resisting the present moment?
Yes.
Yeah.
It doesn't come from the situation. It yeah. comes from your thoughts about the situation.
Because the tire being needing to be changed by itself could not cause you to be stressed.
No, there's no, it just is as it is.
It is as it is.
And if you can see that, then suddenly you move into that, and even there comes gratitude.
Yes. So your stress is about wanting the moment to be different than what it is.
Yes.
And that's whether it's a tire, losing your job, losing a loved one.
Yes.
Okay. And you sum this up, this abundance, by using a quote from Jesus saying, give and it will be given to you. Good measure, pressed down, shaken together, running over, will be put into your lap. That is the truth, so help me. That is just the truth.
Yes, it's an amazing, amazing statement. And also somewhere else, Jesus talks about...
You must like Jesus. You talk about him a lot.
Oh, yes. There was a time when I was brought up as a Catholic, and then I... for many years, I wasn't interested anymore. Mm-hmm. And then after I went through this inner shift, a couple of years afterwards, I happened to pick up the New Testament and I happened to read the Gospels, and mm-hmm. I suddenly saw how deep all this is, these statements.
That's right. And it became more than doctrine for
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And so Jesus somewhere else says, I want you to have life in its fullness. I want you to have the fullness of life. Hmm. And that's a beautiful statement, and people sometimes don't realize what he means by the fullness of life, because in our civilization particularly, the fullness of life means having as many things as possible.
Yes.
And of course, I'm convinced that Jesus was not talking about shopping malls.
Nope.
Because if he was talking about shopping malls, then the kingdom of heaven has already arrived and it's in the shopping malls. So he was not talking about many, many things.
Eckhart made a joke, y'all. Eckhart made a funny.
He was talking about something that is within you. The fullness of life is a dimension within you. And he said, I want you to be in touch with that dimension yeah. within you.
And you are absolutely right. If you get nothing else from this book, if you can get that, then your life will change.
Yes.
Your life will change.
Yes.
That abundance comes only to those who already have it, page 192. It sounds almost unfair, but of course it isn't. It's a universal law. Both abundance and scarcity are inner states that manifest as your reality. Jesus puts it like this, for to the one who has, more will be given, and from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And he's not talking about things.
No.
He's talking about your inner state
yes.
of gratitude
yes.
for what you already have.
Yes.
And your life will change. Laura from Baltimore is on the line, has a question for us. Laura?
Hi, Oprah. Hi, Eckhart.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you so much for this opportunity. You've both been great spiritual teachers for me, and I'm just so grateful.
Thank you.
My question is, before reading this book, I was someone who usually suppressed my emotions. And on page 208, you talk about bringing an inner yes to whatever form that the now takes. So now, when I have the emotion of sadness arise, I try to apply this principle. In the past, I would have said no to the emotion and suppressed it. But now I worry that by saying yes to this emotion, it's just the ego tricking me into feeding the pain body. How can I be sure that emoting is not actually strengthening my ego?
Right, good question.
Mm-hmm.
So when you fully allow an emotion, it implies that you are there as the awareness, the witnessing presence, because it's only from that space that you can say that this is what I feel, and here it is. It's part of the isness of this moment. And if you do that, the emotion cannot rise up into your mind and control your thinking. In other words, it does not become part of ego. It's only if the emotion rises up into your mind and then your mind starts to think along the lines of that particular emotion and thereby feeding more energy to the very same emotion, that means you are strengthening that emotion and it's becoming part of ego. But if you can just look at the emotion and allow it to be, then the emotion is not going to feed on your thoughts anymore. So And then you will actually find when you allow an emotion to be, it subsides fairly quickly.
Yes.
And it's not part of ego. This practice is going beyond emotion without repressing them.
You got that, Laura?
Yes, thank you so much.
Right. I love that. You tell us the story of the Zen master on 199, the one who said, is that so? I mean, I think you have to be a Zen master, practically, to have that kind of reaction to everything in life.
Yes.
You know, because when somebody attacks you, you know, that's a thing I still have to work on, because I live in a world where people write things that are not true all the time. Somebody's working on a biography of me now, unauthorized. It's not, so I know it's going to be lots of things in there that are not true. And so I've gotten better at it, and I know everybody experiences it on one level or another. For me, it's people saying things about me that are not true.
Yes.
It caused me to show myself as a small person. The little me comes out, and I'm like, that's not true! And so this Zen master who's able to say, when he's being accused of, you know, doing something horrible to this girl, is that so? Who can do that?
It's a very extreme form of being one with the present moment. Should I tell this story?
Yes, please do. So
there was a Zen master. He was highly regarded, and he was a spiritual teacher, had a very good reputation. And one day, neighbors of his came to him and said, our daughter is pregnant, and you remember she came to see you about some advice some time ago, and she has now confessed to us that you are the father of this baby that's going to be born out to our 17-year-old daughter. And of course, they didn't tell him this in the way as I'm telling it to you. They were very angry.
True story?
I believe it is.
Okay.
So there was an enormous anger in this situation, you can imagine. And the Zen master was listening to them as they were telling them that he had fathered this child. He was listening in that Zen state of open, alert attention like this. And then when they had finished their story, you are the father of this child, and he said, is that so? Yes, he said, and then when the child is born, you are going to look after the baby because you are responsible. Is that so? And so when the baby was born, they brought the child over to him and said, no, you look after the baby, it's not ours, you are responsible. And he accepted the baby, and the word got round that he had fathered a child by a 17-year-old girl. He lost his reputation, nobody came to see him anymore. Right. He was totally indifferent to this because he was only responding to the needs of the present moment. So he started looking after the baby. And so she spent about a year looking after the baby, and in the meantime, the mother of the baby grew up a little bit more, and suddenly she confessed to her parents that the Zen master was not the father. She just didn't want to tell them that it was the boy who works in the butchers who was the father. And of course, the parents got extremely upset, and they came running to the Zen master and said, she's just told us that you are not the father. He said, is that so? Yes, and so we would like our baby back, please. And so he handed the baby over. There was always, it's the story
that... must be in the Zendom kingdom or something.
Continuous, it's the story that shows an extreme example of absolute non-resistance and the good that comes because the baby was being looked after with loving care for a whole year by this Zen master.
But why wouldn't the Zen master, because he's a Zen master, is that the level that you are saying that we should be striving? Well, I know you're not saying we should do anything. We should do whatever we want to do.
It is not necessary. That is only to exemplify.
Because I would be, it is not true! It's not true! Yeah.
Or you can say, no, I'm not the father. It's not true. I'm not the father. So you can say it in one way that is very reactive, and that would be the normal way.
Yes. To,
or you can say it in a way that is free of reaction and nevertheless states the truth. So right. You're still surrendered inside.
Yes.
You're still accepting that these parents, this is where they are at, this is what they believe, mm-hmm. and simply you say, this is not the case, I'm not the father.
Bottom line is you're saying don't get pulled into the drama.
Yes.
Don't get pulled into the drama.
Yes.
State your case, state the facts, without allowing your ego to be pulled into the drama of it.
Yes.
And then be able to move on.
That's right.
That's what you're saying.
That's it.
Okay, we've got Fatima on the line from Kuwait? Hello, Fatima?
Hello?
Hello?
Hi, Oprah.
Hi.
Hi, Eckhart.
Hi.
Nice to see you, or hear you. Hi.
Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Go ahead with your question.
Okay, great. Since we are used to identifying ourselves with what we have and what we do, I would like to ask you, Oprah and Eckhart, to identify yourselves without names or any form of identification so other people can get a better understanding of who they are and what you mentioned on page 186.
Okay, Eckhart, go right ahead and do that.
The sound wasn't so good.
She was saying, since we're so accustomed to identifying ourselves through labels and what we do, she would like for you and I would like for you, to identify yourself without using those labels of identification so that everybody listening can get a better idea then of how then do you describe yourself?
Yes, so we are talking about being with another person. When you identify yourself, you identify yourself to another person.
Yes.
So there's a situation where you meet somebody, perhaps mm-hmm. somebody mm-hmm. you don't know yet.
Yes.
And so you can be there as an ego entity, in which case you would immediately explain your achievements, or you would immediately explain your sufferings or your diseases that you identify with, mm-hmm. or the whatever.
Sometimes people do it this way, which annoys me. They'll say, what school did you go to?
Yes.
That's immediately to say whether or not you're in the category.
That's right.
Yeah, what school did you
go to?
So
people, they want to, as the mind, that's what the human mind does, they want to be able to classify you. They want to be able to find out where they can put you in there. So they're asking questions about that, but you don't need to be drawn into that and realize that as you, and this is a very, very
okay,
important
so let's
thing.
Say we didn't know you and you're at a gathering where people don't know you.
Yes.
And I come up and I introduce myself and I say, hello, I'm Oprah.
Yes.
And I'm here with a convention and I'm, you know, I sold so many pharmaceuticals and I did so this is Anna. I've got 3 kids, I live in Oregon, whatever. How would you then describe yourself?
Well, perhaps I would not use that many words, but some words might be there. I wouldn't say I am formless spirit or anything like that.
You wouldn't do that?
No.
Hello, I am formless spirit, Eckhart.
I once asked somebody, I met somebody at a reunion, and they knew that I had already written The Power of Now, so I was a spiritual teacher. And so I asked for some reason, we had a conversation, and I asked, how old are you? And he said, I was never born. He really wanted to teach me a lesson.
Oh, boy.
No, so you can be quite normal in your interaction, but more important is on a sensing level, you are there as a field of aware presence. And in an interaction with another human being, what matters is not so much the words that are being said. There's a deeper level of the awareness that arises, the field, I call it the field of awareness that arises between two human beings.
Mm-hmm.
The field of presence that arises when those two human beings, or even just one of them, is not totally identified with their thinking mind and the ego.
Mm.
Then I can be there as a conscious presence. Right now, as I sit here, I'm here as a conscious presence.
So you wouldn't say I'm Eckhart, formless spirit. You would just say I'm Eckhart.
Eckhart.
I'm Eckhart.
Yes.
And if they say, well, hey, what do you do?
Yes, then I give a conventional answer. So I'm a writer.
Mm-hmm.
And then they ask, what do you write about? And then depending on, I kind of sense where they are at,
mm-hmm.
whether it's a genuine question and they truly want to know, or whether it's a question when I come into the States from Canada every week, they ask me, what do you do? And then I say, I'm a writer. And then they ask, what do you write about? And then I'm not going to give a deep answer because they don't want a deep answer.
Right.
I'm
They're not really interested.
No.
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 Yeah.
So I give conventional answers.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, in every human interaction, even such an interaction as this, when the immigration, always what is, can you need to be able to sense that there is a presence underneath whatever you're saying.
That's right.
Feel your own presence underneath it.
And that's what we're going to be talking about next week, is to be able to bring, that is our role in this lifetime,
yes,
is to bring that sense of presence, who you really are, not the small little self that is a, you know, yeah, has eating disorders or shops too much or all the other things that we define as in our horizontal lives,
yes,
as ourselves, but to bring that presence into your active life.
That's right, yes.
Yes, that is our goal.
Yes.
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 All right, let's talk about the joy of being. Unhappiness or negativity is a disease on our planet. What pollution is on the outer level is negativity. Page 213, everybody. What pollution is on the outer level is negativity on the inner. It is everywhere, not in just places where people don't have enough, I love this, but even more so where they have more than enough. The affluent world is even more deeply identified with form, more lost in content, more trapped in ego.
Yes.
I thought that was interesting.
Yes. Sometimes you see, you know, when you visit certain places where people have relatively little, often you see more happy faces and radiant
That's
faces
right.
than in our rich society.
Mm-hmm.
So, the passage is about negativity,
mm-hmm,
and there's an enormous amount of negativity in the collective energy field of our planet, but it is generated by individuals. So it's everybody's task to be alert so that when negativity arises within them, they recognize it,
mm-hmm,
and then ask themselves whether that is what they choose.
Mm.
When you recognize it, you can be there as the presence, and you have a choice. Is negativity ever the optimum way of dealing with any situation? And if you look closely, you'll see it never is,
mm-hmm,
a good way of dealing with any situation.
Okay, you say on page 214, the joy of being, which is the only true happiness, cannot come to you through any form, possession, achievement, person, or event, and that means people who think that I'm with you and I love you and you're gonna bring me joy, cannot.
No.
Yes, you either are joy or you're not.
Yes.
Okay? Through anything that happens, that joy cannot come to you ever. It emanates from the formless dimension within you, from consciousness itself, and thus is one with who you are.
Yes, it comes from within and not from without. People conventionally expect it to come to them from without, and then it usually doesn't, because it's you need to discover it in yourself first. And this is why when you try to manifest things in your life, which is a fine thing to do,
mm-hmm,
but the vital question is, have you, first of all, already come to that place of fullness and joy within yourself,
mm-hmm,
right now? Have you found the right relationship with the present moment?
Mm-hmm.
If you haven't, because that's where it resides. It's only by having a right relationship with the present moment that the joy can arise from within you.
You talk about that on 210 when you say to awaken within the dream is our purpose now. When we are awake within the dream, the ego-created earth drama comes to an end and a more benign and wondrous dream arises, this new earth. Also, let's go to page 215, everybody. The top of 215, you talk about a powerful spiritual practice is consciously to allow the diminishment of ego. Because what we've been learning through A New Earth is that most of us have, until reading this book, believed we were our egos, believed we were, as Eckhart has said earlier in tonight, we believed we were our horizontal life without the vertical. We believed we were our past. We believe we are what we're going to do and what we have done. And the the now was always just a sort of means to an end.
Yes.
Okay? So you say a powerful spiritual practice is consciously to allow the diminishment of ego when it happens without attempting to restore the ego. I recommend that you experiment with this from time to time. For example, when someone criticizes you, blames you, or calls you names, I got to tell you, it's hard to say, is that so? instead of immediately retaliating or defending yourself, do nothing. Allow the self-image to remain diminished and become alert to what that feels like deep inside you. So what's that supposed to do for us?
Now, it's not, I'm not saying in each case you should do that. I experiment with this from time to time. Mm-hmm. When, particularly when nothing depends on that situation. So you don't have to explain something so that a situation can be put right or whatever. Somebody just calls you, we talked about it the other day.
Somebody cuts you off in traffic?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So that would be a good practice, but it's totally pointless to retaliate.
Yes.
It makes no sense whatsoever. So, but the retaliation when somebody calls you names in traffic or whatever...
Or does something to upset you.
Yes.
Try doing nothing.
Yes. The retaliation is automatic and unconscious because it comes from the ego. Because when somebody calls you stupid, for example,
right,
or somebody calls you idiot, it injures the ego. It hurts the ego tremendously.
And it's the ego that's being injured, not you.
Not you. It's nothing, because deep down you know that it's not you. It's just the ego image of who I think I am.
Deep down you know it's not you, but if you are a person who lives unconsciously, out of your ego, you think it's you.
Yes.
Yes.
And immediately the ego will go into what I call instant self-repair mechanism. And this instant self-repair mechanism, which is totally unconscious...
Says, I am not stupid.
Well, it will call the other person something worse than stupid. And by that, the ego believes that it has repaired itself, and on that level, it has. So this person has taken something away from you, the imaginary ego, and then you take something away from that other person. This is how the egos work. And then, of course, it's probably not the end, because the other person is going to retaliate again.
Right. And now you're in it.
The whole madness starts.
Now you're in the drama.
Yes. So this is a good example where you can practice being non-reactive. So when somebody calls you something, remain totally...
And you say when that happens, just do it for a few seconds. It may feel uncomfortable, as it will, just to keep your mouth shut. I've had that this week. Just to keep your mouth shut.
Yes.
It's hard. It feels like you've shrunk in size for momentarily. Then you may sense an inner spaciousness that feels intensely alive. You haven't been diminished at all. In fact, you have expanded. What do you mean by that?
Yes. So somebody, you are not, what you are not defending is your egoic identity, the image identity. And that suddenly, that has become diminished by somebody calling you stupid, for example. This entity has become diminished. You don't resist the diminishment, so it has become smaller, so to speak. And therefore, suddenly, something that is deeper than that can suddenly come through because the ego has shrunk in size.
I got it.
No, the ego doesn't like that.
That's
but
right.
It's a wonderful experiment when you allow the ego to shrink, and then suddenly you feel there is a power underneath that that's far greater than
the ego. And it shrinks every time you become aware of
Yes, yes.
Even when you don't do what you're supposed to do?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
I like this question from Suhad in Clifton, New Jersey. How can we use the high-quality no that you talk about on page 216 in our lives? Can you please provide us with some real-life examples? 216, high-quality no. What did you mean by high-quality no?
In some cases, sometimes people misunderstand when I say yes to the present moment. They believe then whenever somebody asks you something,
you have to say yes. Yeah.
No, when I say yes to the present moment, it's to do with an inner state of consciousness.
Yes.
That is open to what is, that does not resist what is. It does not necessarily mean that every time somebody asks you something, you say yes. So let's say a person comes to you, you've known him, you've already lent him money 5 times, he's never returned it.
Or two's enough.
Two is enough. And so he says, I need another $500 now. And then you perhaps, this may be a good opportunity, an occasion where you can use a high-quality no that is not reactive and does not make that person wrong and say, becomes angry and or shouts at him and say, you are dishonest, you haven't returned my money, and I'm not giving you a penny more. Well, this is a low-quality no.
Low quality.
A high quality no is to say,
who do you think you are?
All that kind all that of stuff. Stories in order to stories. Make wrong.
Yes, I've given you money so many times before.
Yes, and then you make yourself into a victim.
Yes.
It's all part of.
Or make
of...
yourself into the great person who's
yes.
been so benevolent.
Yes, yeah. Whatever the egoic game is. Mm-hmm. So the high quality no is to simply state, well, I've already given you that money twice and you haven't returned it yet, so. I won't give you any more. You have to return my money first. I'm mm-hmm. not going to give you. Can you sense that there's no negativity? You simply state clearly, this is what I'm going to do or not do. I won't give you any more because you haven't returned that.
Yeah.
And
yeah. That happened to me recently. Somebody was asking me money and just say, no, I won't do that. Yeah. And no emotion attached to it at all.
Yeah.
All right, I just want to say here that I love this on 220. What you see, hear, feel, touch, or think about is only one half of reality, so to speak. Mm-hmm. It is form. In the teaching of Jesus, it's simply called the world, and the other dimension is the kingdom of heaven or eternal life. Then toward the bottom of the page, second to last paragraph, you say, the collective disease of humanity is that people are so engrossed in what happens, so hypnotized by the world of fluctuating forms, so absorbed in the content of their lives, they have forgotten the essence, that which is beyond content, beyond form, beyond thought. They're so consumed by time that they have forgotten eternity, which is their origin, their home, their destiny. Eternity is the living reality of who you are. And that's what I felt on that mountain that day.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. And you can actually sense it, although that's a wonderful thing when you can be surrounded by the stillness.
Yeah.
But the amazing thing is you can actually sense that even in the midst of chaos, even in the midst of noise, I have felt also what you describe. I've also very often felt that in nature. Mm-hmm. But I have also felt that extreme peace in situations where one wouldn't expect it. I felt it in the middle of London, in busy streets, walking around, especially after I went through this shift before I went through the shift, I was always anxious and fearful, and I couldn't stand the traffic and the noise. And suddenly I was able to just walk along Piccadilly Circus and be totally at peace, as if I were on a mountaintop inside. Mm-hmm. So when you...
Mountaintop inside.
Inside, yeah.
And that's what presence is it not?
Yes.
Presence is being on the mountaintop inside.
Yes, yes. Yeah. You have, that stillness is always there. In you as the essence of who you are. And when we call it stillness, we already limit it because it's so vast, you cannot describe it with one word.
Right.
So whatever word you use is already a limitation. But words are limited, of course, because words refer to tangible things, mm-hmm. but not to the inner reality.
Mm-hmm. So before we say goodbye, let's sum up what we've covered in this class. Knowing who you really are means knowing.
Yes, knowing at a level beyond the level of concepts, knowing yourself ultimately is being yourself fully, being in touch with being, the being that you are. To sense the I am, that is the essence of your identity, when you remove all the identifications that usually you say, after you say I am, you say what you are. Mm-hmm. But if you say I am and add nothing to it, that is a good practice. It can get you in touch with the essence. I am not this, I am not that. I am, as a simple meditation, mm-hmm. repeat the words, I am to yourself.
It's so powerful. I started to do that. It is so yes. powerful when
and,
you do that.
And don't fill in the blank after yeah. the words.
Yeah.
Very powerful. Another similar one is, who am I? It's a question. But don't look to the mind for an answer. In fact, don't look for any answer, especially not on the level of mind. Who am I? And then allow the stillness to be there after the question. Don't look for an answer. And in not looking for an answer, there's the answer, but it's not a mental concept, mm. as of sensing,
wow.
feeling.
I am.
Yes, I am.
and just be with that.
Yes.
Yes. And so for whether it's an addiction or an eating disorder or nothing, you think you have a really wonderful life, but you are connected to all the things in your life, to the content of your life.
Yes.
Just being able to sit with yourself and to say those words to yourself, I am.
It's wonderfully liberating.
And to recognize them.
Yes.
To know them.
Yes.
Like honey.
Yes.
To know them.
That's
like
right.
Honey. Thank you again.
Thank you.
I want to thank you all for joining us. The seventh class will be available on demand tomorrow, Finding Who You Truly Are, for free here at Oprah.com. And if you want to download or watch any of our classes, of course, you know this by now, you can do that tomorrow at Oprah.com and at iTunes. It's free because of the generous support of people like Nature Made Soft Gel Vitamins. This week, update your workbook and get ready for our next class on Chapter 8. It's the discovery of inner space. I love this. It's my next favorite chapter. I think 7, 8, and 9 are really the essence of the book. Inner space is about allowing the inner space of your life to connect to the outer purpose of your life, the inner and outer purposes of your life, right?
That's right.
Yes. Love it. Again, we thank you. This was a long chapter, lots to cover.
Yes.
I would say to everybody, I mean, I was sick in bed this weekend and read it again for the third time. Every time I read it, I go a little deeper and awaken a little more.
Yes.
So this is one you need to be with for
definitely.
A while, over and over.
And after you've read it once, you don't need to read long pages. Just read, sometimes half a page is enough.
Yes.
One page.
What I do is I go back and read. This is what I would do. As you're using your highlighters, just go back and read what you've highlighted and just be with that. Because the things that you highlight are usually things that resonate with you more deeply. It's a good way of reviewing it. And every time you come back to it, you know, 2 weeks from now, you'll get something that you didn't get the first time.
Yes.
Oh, yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Eckhart. Thanks, everybody.